ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So we're continuing on page 41-42 on about the Paramatma, about his all-pervasiveness. So I think we were down at the... Did we finish 4, the second paragraph of 4?
Yeah.
We did. Okay, so we're on 5. In this verse, the word Bheda refers to the Supreme Lord's presence in many places. It does not refer to the Lord's perfection or imperfection. In Srimad Bhagavatam 1.9.30.43, Bhishma Dev glorified the transcendental form of the Lord. These prayers clearly do not glorify the impersonal Brahman aspect of the Supreme. In this way, we have now described how the Supreme Personality of Godhead is manifest within a limited area of space. It is also all-pervading, present within the hearts of all moving and non-moving creatures. So here's the point, is that someone may say, because we're saying, some say he's this size, at the same time as the all-pervasiveness. Because you have the problem is that someone would say, well, if he's all-pervasive, how can he be in one place? And if he's in one place, how can he be all-pervasive? You understand? Because then the impersonalist concept, if God is actually everywhere, he has to be everywhere and not in a form. Does that make sense? So these are very technical points that in one sense may or may not seem relevant to us because we're convinced. But at the same time, as we have to preach, we're going to have more and more to talk with this. One may say, okay, no, Westerners, they don't know anything. But actually, it's becoming very different. And the unfortunate thing is that field of them becoming very familiar with Eastern philosophy is not necessarily coming from us. Right? I mean, I was just given a magazine yesterday from a yoga society that runs in New York. And they use all the technical terms and they get into everything that our devotees are worried, oh, if I talk like that, the Westerners will never understand. Very technical, completely into the Indian, you know, sadhu scene and yoga and that, no problem. You know? Like that. So now when you preach in the future, you now will find that preaching in these yoga circles and in these new age circles will be the, you know, a very, how you say? What would be the word? It means that it's very favorable. You know? These will be very favorable circles to preach in. But you're going to have people that are very familiar with all these concepts and with Brahman, and then they'll be the ones that'll have these questions because they'll all be impersonalists. And they'll be the thing, well, if you say Paramatma is there, but how is he all-pervading? Does that make sense? So it doesn't necessarily mean anything to us now, but in a few years we'll find it does. Right? Because in the West, previously, no one knew anything about philosophy like that. You'd have a few academics here or there. You don't rarely bump into them. Right? But now your common people are going to be talking about karma and this. You see it in movies nowadays, just regular mainstream movies, people talking about karma. Do you believe in karma, or that's your karma, or... You understand? Well, we're busy, you know, trying to fit in. Everybody else is becoming Eastern religionized, and it's not us. Okay, so basically means now we understand is that he's pointed out is how he can be in one place. He's all pervading, but this as Paramatma in his form, and at the same time as Garbhodaksha Vishnu through his energies, he's also all pervading. Does that make sense? Right, the universal form has pervaded everything. It's just the energies. But at the same time, as Paramatma, he's also entered everything. So, because otherwise, if we stopped at Garbhodaksha Vishnu, everything's done. Right? The energies are all there. The material world will function. Right? And he's conscious enough that him sitting, on, you know, where he's sitting, he can know what everybody's thinking anyway. He doesn't necessarily have to sit in their hearts. Does that make sense? But if he doesn't do that, I mean, it's one of the things is by doing that, then it shows that even though he's everywhere by his energies and everything is Brahman, at the same time as he also can still simultaneously be enter into everything and between everything as the Paramatma. Does that make sense? Right?
Yeah. But I thought that because the Paramatma is in everything, so that makes it Brahman.
No, it's everything's Brahman because it's expanded from God. God is Brahman, so everything coming from him is Brahman. But there are superior and inferior qualities of Brahman. You know, just like you have so many metals, but you'll take gold as more superior and something like iron is less superior. Does that make sense? Right? Like you have one mine. Out of a mine you get so many things, right? If you get gold, it's in some other ore. It's not just chunks of gold there. You know what I'm saying? If you get one metal, you also get other metals along with it. They just go together. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, means God himself is the eternal, ultimate form of Brahman. That expanding from him in his energies, which are also Brahman, but they're energy Brahman. They're not the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Brahman. So then you have internal potency, Brahman, external potency, Brahman, and marginal potency, Brahman. Does that make sense? But, so the point is that's the point. This is all Brahman. It's actually spiritual. But it's inferior spiritual. But because we want to enjoy the spiritual, therefore we can't see the spiritual, because if we say it's spiritual, that means it's connected to God. That means we're not God. Does that make sense? So that's why then Yoga Maya then covers the intelligence so that we think that this is for us to enjoy, so we don't connect it to Brahman. You know, like that. Because otherwise then it's like, it's really hard to enjoy when you know that somebody else is running it all and actually it's all them. You know, so you have to forget that to actually try to enjoy it. But because it's dead matter, that's the inferiority of it, but it's still Brahman dead matter. But so the his own energies then enter it and give it that life that we are looking for, right? You know, like something's dead, you have a new something new. Right? There's some attractiveness to it, some sparkle in it, something special. That's the Lord's potency. But the matter itself is dead. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Is that clear? Okay. Bhakti Sandarbha Anucheda 27 establishes from Bhagavatam 2.2.14 that our devotion is meant to be offered to the seer, not the seen. Consult Srila Prabhupada's purports to verse 14. Bhagavatam 2.2.8 is explained by the same Anucheda. 1. In the next chapter, Srimad Bhagavatam 2.2.14, Srila Sukadeva Goswami says, "Unless the gross materialist develops a sense of loving service under the Supreme Lord, the seer of both the transcendental and material worlds, he should remember or meditate upon the universal form of the Lord at the end of his prescribed duties." Nimesha, note well that the goal is bhakti. Meditation upon the seen, the universe, is only a means to that goal. After word para, the word avarta means the places of the living entities headed by Brahma. Who is there? The Supreme Lord, Vishveshvare, who sees, drashtari, everything, but who, because he is perfectly spiritual, remains invisible to the conditioned souls. Devotional service, bhakti yoga, is described in these words, Srimad Bhagavatam 2.2.8. Others conceive of the personality of Godhead residing within the body in the region of the heart, and measuring only 8 inches, with 4 hands carrying a lotus, a wheel, a chariot, a conch, and a club, respectively. The way of spiritual advancement is described. The word kriyavasane means at the end of one's prescribed duties. One should do this until he develops a sense of loving service to the Lord, bhakti yoga. So what we see is here is that The Lord is seeing everything, and what is seen is the universe. So the universal form is used because it is seen, because we think we are the seer. Right? Does that make sense? So, in other words, we're trying to see the seen. I mean the seer, which is the Lord. He has pervaded everything. He sees everything. He knows everything. And so he's the one that's important, not what is seen, or the material energy, or us. Does that make sense? But because we think we are God, the seer, therefore we start by connecting the seen to the Lord as the universal form. Does that make sense? You catch that or no? No. Okay. It's just the terminology. Seer meaning the one who is actually seeing something, and seen means what is seen. Okay, so God is seeing the material energy, right? So what's important, the seer, God, or the seen, the material energy? Right? Okay, the seer. So actually you're supposed to meditate on the seer, means God, not the seen, the material energy. Does that make sense? But because we don't see God, means we ourselves, the seen, are trying to be the seer, right? We're trying to be God, so we're seeing material energy, right? We don't see God, who's the actual seer. We're the bogus seer, right? Or the secondary seer. We see because he sees. Right? Before, remember in the universal form, when he wants to taste, then taste comes, and then we're able to taste, he wants to see then. So he's actually the one seeing. And we're the one that is actually being seen. But because we don't see him, we think we're God. We think we're the seer, so we look at material energy. Right? So, therefore, if you connect the material energy through the universal form back to Krishna, then we're, even though we're seeing the seen, in that way we actually connect it to the seer. Does that make sense? And then with time, because it's important, the seer, we drop this absorption in the seen. Does that make sense now? Yeah? Sure? Everybody catch it? No. What's the problem? Where do you look? Okay. Try again. God sees. Right? And what does he see? Material energy. So God is, in this case, because we're using the word seer and seen. So seer means God, seen means his energies, right? Is that, you understand seen? It means what is, what you see is what's seen. It's just English terminology. I don't know how it works out in other languages. Does that make sense? Okay. So what we're supposed to see is the seer, God, and not what's seen or the material energy. Right? That should be our meditation, right? We should meditate on God and not the material energy. Yeah? That's clear? But the problem is we think we're God. So we take us that we're the seer, not the seen. Right? Means the material energy and us are seen. God sees us. Does that make sense? Okay? Yes? No? Okay. It's just like when you go into the temple, then it's actually us being seen by Krishna. Because he sees us, we can see him. Does that make sense? So we're the seen, not him. He's the seer. Right? Because he sees everybody. Right? We only see some things, but he sees everything. Right? So he's the actual seer. Right? Does that make sense? Just like you have a rich man. Who would you consider the rich man? The guy with the most money or the guy with 10 rupees? Right? So the guy with 10 rupees has 10 rupees. Right, but he has 10 rupees because the government has billions of rupees. Does that make sense? So actually the government's the one that's rich. Right? And then that money is distributed so that we can use it. But the money belongs to the government. You know what I'm saying? All the pieces of paper we can't say are ours. We're allowed to use them, but they actually are the property of the government because we can't do anything we want with them. You rip up pieces of paper and do things, then you can actually be punished for that. Does that make sense? So the seeing power is God's. So that's very simple. So we just see Krishna. But the problem is we're so habituated to seeing the material energy. Right? That's because we think we're God and we're the seer. But we're not. We're actually the seen. Does this make sense? Okay. So, because we think the material energy is for us to see, then we have to see Krishna in it. Then that will purify our propensity to be the seer, so that we actually know he's the seer, and then we accept that we're the seen. Does that make sense now? Yeah? Okay. Is that clear? Everybody happy now? Yeah? Yeah? Okay. And then it says, at the end of one's prescribed duties means, it can mean a few things. One, it could mean within the aspect of prescribed duties, the end of it means when one renounces the material world, or the sannyas element, right? Sannyas means working without a desire for result, right? Does that make sense? That's the meaning of sannyas. Otherwise, it's giving up the result, that's renunciation, right? But sannyas means your work is not being done for the result anyway. You know, you go and you cook for Krishna, right? You're not cooking for yourself. There will be a result, but that result's not for you. That's sannyas. Does that make sense? But if you cook, and then you've cooked a nice preparation for yourself, then you renounce it and give it to Krishna, that's renunciation. That's tyag. Does that make sense? You go into your house, you're hungry. Oh, what do I want to eat? So then I cook what I want to eat. Then, oh, now I should offer it to Krishna. Right? That's tyag. That's austerity. Right? But if your purpose was to cook something for Krishna, not for yourself, that's sannyas. Does that make sense? It's just a difference in mentality. So the idea is, there's the gross forms of it just to make sure that it goes on. In other words, everyone's supposed to get to the position of the mentality of sannyas. Does that make sense? So, there is a mechanical, external form of going through brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas. Right? To make sure that everybody gets there. Right? But the external form is actually not what we're looking for. What we're looking for is the detachment from fruitive action. Right? So the body, mind, and words are engaged in the Lord's service. That's the meaning of sannyas. So that anybody can do. Right? So it doesn't matter what ashram or varna you're in, you can be sannyas. Because whatever you do is being done to please Krishna. Just make sense? Right? The external form is just to make sure that you do it. Right? Let's say you go to somebody's new to the etiquettes of your country, right? And you come in and you're supposed to say greeting in a certain way, and there's some kind of how you shake hands. You know, it's just like, let's say, most countries, if you meet a couple, you shake the man's hand first, then the woman's hand first. But from what I've understood, let's say, I've heard in Sweden, you shake the woman's hand first, then the man's hand. Like that. So each one has its own uniqueness. So if you already know it, it just happens. You don't have to worry about it. So the important thing is not, oh, this one's done for, then that. It's just there's interaction, right? The interaction, what's important. But if not, you have to go through, oh, okay, now I'm supposed to do this and make sure I get it all right and everything. Does that make sense? So that's what the whole point. The external form of varnashram is just to make sure that it happened, right? Means if you want to do something, you have to have knowledge first, right? First is shravana, right? Then is manana. Manana means contemplation and practice, right? So shravana has to be there. So therefore, brahmacharya means you dedicating your life to shravana, hearing, right? Does that make sense? Then, then the grihastha then practices these things and contemplates it. Though the practice will be more, contemplation less. Vanaprastha means contemplation more, practice less. Right? Then it's supposed to come to the stage of nididhyasana, or realization. Does that make sense? So we see just naturally in the orders it's like that. So, but if, because one doesn't know this, means you will do this if you have the realization, right? But if there's no realization, will we do it? No. Therefore, there's the external form of Varnashram to make sure we do it. Because otherwise, if you realize the importance of Brahmacharya, everyone would follow it. No one would waste it, you know, just, you know, playing around, running after the girls. That they wouldn't do it if they actually understood what it was going to do to their practice later in life. If they actually understood that only a good Brahmachari makes a good Grihastha, then all these boys would be being good Brahmacharis because they want to be with women. Does that make sense? Because if you're not sense controlled and you're not sensitive and you don't have a service attitude, you can't function in the society of women. Right? Why is it breaking down now? Because there's so much more of this macho thing. There's no culture. There's no respect. You see, you go back in the older, the, you know, what we, I don't know if they even call it the old school now, maybe the prehistoric school now or something. That, you know, when I grew up, there was old school, new school, and now it's like, but the old school was like you had the, you know, even in the West, the old kind of like European cultural values of society and respect for the women and, you know, certain things were done and taken care of and all these different things. That means the man has to be sense controlled and he has to be sensitive. Right? And he learned that by, not by just hanging out with the women, but actually by doing things with the men. Does that make sense? The boys would be off with the men. They go off hunting, they go work, they go do all these different things. They didn't have a rule you had to be in school till you're 18. Right? Does that make sense? So, if that was understood, people would do it. But it's not understood. So they think, you know, if I don't start practicing now, I'll never be good at it, you know? But it's not like that. It's a matter of you have these qualities and character, then it works. Yeah? So, because that's not understood, right? You know, what adolescence understands this. Therefore, there's the external form of the Varnashram to ensure that they are a good student. Right? Then they'll go on and be a good grihastha. A good grihastha will be a good vanaprastha. A good vanaprastha will be a good sannyasa. Does that make sense? But the whole idea actually is that everybody in the Varnashram system is actually sannyas. This is according to Narad Muni. He preaches Pancharatra, which means the Vedic system focused simply on the Lord. Means those things that are actually directly connected to the Lord. Right? You worship the deity. So everything you do is connected to the Lord. Right? This is called Aikayana. Right? So, but because people can't do that fully, therefore he's taken the other aspects of the Vedic culture, right? And connected those to Krishna through Naishkarmya. Right? In other words, you take the Vedic rules and regulations. Out of those, the bulk of them are for just our general day-to-day life. And some of those are directly connected to the Lord. Right? You take all those ones that are directly connected to the Lord, put them all in one place, that's called the Pancharatra. Right? In other words, the Vedic rules that are connected to deity worship is called Pancharatra. All the rest of it, we would just call Varnashram. Right? But the Pancharatra is actually taken from that Varnashram. Or you could say the Varnashram has expanded from that Pancharatra, whichever way. Now, Naishkarmya means you take those parts that aren't Ekayana Pancharatra, and you take those, and through Naishkarmya, means performing them without the desire for the result, then you connect it to the Supreme. Yeah? Does that make sense? So, that's what he says. So, Naishkarmya technically means sannyas. Because your purpose is for please the Lord and for self-realization. It's not for us, but because we have the attachment to these areas, therefore we work in these areas because we like to be in that environment. Does that make sense? That's an environment we're comfortable with because of our conditioned nature. So we put ourselves in that environment, but the results of that we give to are given to Krishna, or better yet, are done for Krishna. Does that make sense? This is what the Bhagavad Gita is talking about, Sakam Nishkam. So Narad Muni's angle is everybody should be engaged in the, you know, Bhagavat Panch and Pancharatrik and the Shnaishkarmiya, the Vedic. Right? Does that make sense? This is what he preaches. He preaches Pancharatra and Naishkarmiya. Does that make sense? So is that clear how technically the Vedic culture is designed so that everybody in it is actually sannyas by mentality? Right? Though externally, for social functioning, according to your conditioned nature, you will situate yourself in that varnan ashram that is comfortable for you to perform that naishkarmya, or that sannyas, right? In other words, sannyas means that the body, mind, and words are engaged in Lord's service. So, what activities would you like, I mean, what kind of body do you have, what kind of mind, what kind of senses do you have, then it's natural that those areas, one would be comfortable doing those, connecting those to Krishna. Does that make sense? Right? Someone's very strong. So they would do activities that require strength for Krishna. But they're doing it just to please Krishna, not for themselves. Someone else doesn't have strength. They'll do activities that don't require that for Krishna. Right? Someone likes to study, teach. Someone likes to administrate, you know, and protect. Someone likes to create economics. Someone likes to be engaged in arts. Right? Does that make sense? So it actually doesn't matter. It's only among the mundane that you make a category of higher, lower, and that. It doesn't matter. If you engage your arts fully in Krishna's service for his pleasure, that's perfect. Or if you engage your management or your economics or your studies. Right? Only on the mundane we make this hierarchy. Does that make sense? Because the whole point is you have a particular conditioned nature, it can do certain things. It's not good for doing other things. Yeah? If you're a manager, you're good to, you can manage. So not managing, well, you won't be fully engaged. Right? Does that make sense? That's what you see. Prabhupada, whatever would be the situation, his managers, he's always engaged in managing. Whether they were more Krishna conscious or less Krishna conscious. Because that's the only way they can be fully absorbed. Does that make sense? Yeah. So then the whole idea is to do that for Krishna. Right? So that's sannyas. Does that make sense? That's what the opening of the 18th chapter of Gita is pointing out, what actually is sannyas, because that's what we're trying to get to. Right? So, either one can develop that on one, you know, naturally like that, or one can go through the process. But in either case, the idea is one should develop it, right? Somebody may be very naturally talented in something, and someone has to work very hard to become talented in it. But it doesn't matter, as long as you develop the talent. Right? Does that make sense? Like that. Okay. So therefore we can say at the end of one's prescribed duties, meaning if you're going through the mechanical, yes, then at the end comes sannyas. So at least at that point you should be meditating upon the Lord rather than the material energy. Right? But at the same time as here also, at the end of one's prescribed duties means when prescribed duties have ended because one is absorbed simply in the Lord's service. Does that make sense? So you have this dual overlap that it can mean time, it can be a thing of a progression, but it can also be something that's happening now. You know what I'm saying? It means as a brahmachari, you could come to this stage of sannyas, or as a grihastha, you could come to it. But it doesn't mean that it has to be you've come to this state mentality of sannyas at sannyas. Right? Right? That's the mechanical form of it. But the form that's actually being recommended is right now you come to that mentality. Right? That's Krishna's first recommendation. Surrender them fully right this second. Not even second. This moment, right? Because there's a moment's 1/11th of a second. So a second's a bit long, right? Like Maharaj Katvanga had a moment. He didn't say he had a second. He had a moment. So, does that make sense? Are you okay? Okay. And at the same time is that the mechanics of it one should do until one develops a sense of loving devotional service, right? So in other words, if we are so absorbed in the scene, you know, in other words, the material energy, then connected to Krishna and keep doing that until it comes to the point where a sense of loving devotion starts to come. It doesn't say that it's come. That sense of it, because that will bring you to Him, and then the material energy, that meditation will fade away. Does that make sense? Right? In other words, what's recommended is the spontaneous attraction, right? We described before the different kinds of attraction. So spontaneous attraction is the ideal. But attraction will develop by habit. So if you continually practice sadhana bhakti, that habit of constantly putting yourself in contact with Krishna and the devotees and His holy name and like this, then we'll also develop that attraction. Does this make any sense? Okay. You had a question? Okay. Bhaktisandarbha Anucheda 29 establishes from Bhagavatam 2.2.34 that devotional service is the conclusion of all Vedic scriptures. Right, so before we've taken is that there's the Lord, and then He's all-pervading, but He's a person. Then there should be devotion to that person, right? We started off the all-pervading aspect of the universal form. Then we brought it to, more important, is that person. So that person is the super soul, right? Then from there we've taken is that, so devotion to Him is important, right? Devotion to Him is more important than devotion to the universal form. Right? Then, now we're bringing it that these devotional service to that person, that's the conclusion of the Vedic literature. Right? So we can see Jiva Goswami is taking us logically through these steps. Right? These are very in detail, but what one of the things to gain is to see his progression of points. So if you're dealing with someone more simple, then you just have to make one point and move through. And if someone more intellectual or more stubborn, then you may have to give more points. So then Jiva Goswami has given all these points just so that can be done. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. See 34th purport. That devotional service is the conclusion of all the Vedas is explained in these words, Srimad Bhagavatam 2.2.34. The great personality Brahma, with great attention and concentration of the mind, studied the Vedas three times. And after scrutinizingly examining them, he ascertained that attraction for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, is the highest perfection of religion. Right, so this is a very important conclusion that we were discussing before. Brahma has gone through the four Vedas three times. So that means he knows what he's, you know, he's gone through it, he's understood. So, and from that, he's taken that the highest perfection of religion is devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. Right? So there's so many forms of Godhead, Sri Krishna is the best. So many forms of yoga, bhakti is the best. So devotion to Krishna is the best. Yeah? Nimisha, why did Brahma study the Shastra thrice? He began his study from the point of view of karma, then jnana, and at last bhakti. Also, so you have that aspect, because you'll generally see the form of it, then you'll understand the metaphysics behind it, then you actually understand the devotion. So that's natural anyway. But when you go through the first time, you get familiar with what's there. The second time, you actually start to see it, and the third time, you can actually put it all together. Does that make sense? So that's just a normal thing. If you really want to do something nice, then this is what's done. 3. Here the word Bhagavan means the demigod Brahma. And Kutastha means with great attention and concentration of mind. That is the meaning. Tri means three times. Karshnyaya, Kartsnyaya means thoroughly. Brahma means the Vedas. And Anviksya means examining. In this way he ascertained Manishaya, Adyavasyat, that attraction, Rati, for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, Atmani, an attraction that is also called devotional service, is the highest perfection of religion. Right, so he's trying to point out here clearly why he's going through this word by word, so there'll be no mistake. Right? I mean, it's a little boring, but it's just to be thorough. This here is, he's being, Karshnaya means thoroughly, right? So like that, means, and examining, right? Anviksha. So you don't want to just, okay, he just kind of like went through them quickly. No, he went through very seriously, very carefully, examining it completely, right? Then he's come to this conclusion. Otherwise, one can say, okay, he went through, but that was superficial. But if you really want to know, then it's something different. Does that make sense? So they're proving that Brahma really did a serious job at studying the Vedas. Therefore, we should take his statement as authoritative. Right? In other words, he is an authority to say that the Vedas, the purpose of them is to know the Supreme Lord. Is that okay? Yeah. And here's Rati, attraction for the Supreme Personality of Godhead in devotion. That makes sense? So this attraction is what we're trying to do. Right now we're attracted to the material energy. Right? So through the universal form we connect that attraction of the material energy back to Krishna. So technically what we've done is we've diverted our attention from the material energy to Krishna. So indirectly we're actually attracted to Krishna. You understand? But material consciousness means we're not aware of that. Spiritual consciousness means, devotional consciousness means we are aware of that. So that rati may not be spontaneous, but it's intellectual. Right? So it is there. Right, isn't it? Does that make sense? So some attraction, some connection is important. Whatever it is. That's the thing. Because it's connected to Krishna, it doesn't matter. It starts off your attraction as intellectual, whatever, it doesn't matter at all. Right? As long as it's there, then then the process is started. Does that make sense? Like somebody is only attracted to prasadam tastes nice. They don't know why, but they just keep eating the Sunday feast and how many weeks it takes before they move into the temple. Right? Even though they just started off just to taste nice, that's all. But that taste has been connected to Krishna, because it is Krishna. So they're attracted to Krishna, though they think it's the halava. Like that. I mean, I don't want to offend anyone here if you're one of those ones that did not join because of the halava. I know there are devotees that are very staunch on that point. I did not join this movement because of the halava. Right? They want to say, because of, you know, my great intellectual prowess and all that kind of stuff. That's why I joined. So, whatever. Okay? I mean, I know I joined because of the halava. So, like that. But I have heard devotees when I make the point. You know, generally you make it and everybody appreciates it, but now and again you get someone who's, no, I was, Arta, Artarchi, Jigyasu, Gyani, I was a Gyani, yes, here I am, so, like that. Okay, so that attraction, we're attracted to the material energy, so we're just trying to switch it from material energy to Krishna, right? Which is a very simple thing. That's all we're trying to do. But it's a science. Right? Therefore it gets so complex. Because we're so entangled in the web of material life, that the system is as complex as we are entangled. Does that make sense? Whatever entanglement you can have, there's an aspect of the system that addresses that. So basically, what is our attachments? We simply have to connect that to Krishna. And then those attachments will be purified. Then with time, the person that is actually the origin of our attachment becomes more important than the external form of Maya that we are mistaking to be the source of that attachment. Does that make sense? Right? The universal form has put its energy into something. We're attached to it. We think it's the thing itself, not the Lord's energies or the Lord Himself. But with time and practice, we start to see it's actually the Lord that's attractive. So then we start to turn our attention to that person. And we're not attracted to the material energy. And then whatever it is we're dealing with, it's not a matter, oh, now we renounce that. No, it doesn't have to, because it reminds you of Krishna, right? The gopis didn't have to renounce the trees of Vrindavan. Right? Because the black trees, the tamal trees, remind them of Krishna. Does that make sense? So it's not a problem. If it reminds you of Krishna, what's the problem? Just in the beginning, it's external, and then with time, it actually becomes personal. Does that make sense? Here the word Atmani refers to Lord Hari. This is described in the Tantras. Because He is all-pervading, At, and because He is Supreme Mother or Source, Ma, the Personality of Godhead, Hari, is called Atma. Huh. Okay. Because He's the Mother or Source. Mother means Source, right? Like that, because nourishment, that's the motherly aspect. So Krishna maintains, so that's actually the motherly element, right? But He does that through His energies. That makes sense? Like that. So they're not separated. He is all-pervading and the source. The individual soul is not the source, right? That's why the previous thing is you go back to the seer, not the seen. Nimisha. Now Srila Jiva Goswami offers another meaning of the verse. The word Bhagavan here shows that He has all knowledge and a host of virtues. For this reason, His studying the Vedas three times is only a pastime. He merely imitated the actions of other students of the Vedas. Seeing that they contain the limitless glories of Vaikuntha and were studied by numberless Brahmas, the demigod Brahma studied the Vedas. The word kutastha means that while He was studying, He manifested only one form. Misha. Why does Srila Jiva Goswami offer this explanation? That Brahma's study was merely a pastime. He is underscoring that Vedas are understandable only by Sri Krishna Himself. Even if Brahma studies the Vedas thrice, he cannot know them as fully as the Supreme Lord does. Krishna personally teaches us, as we find Him cited by Sri Jiva next. The Lord Himself explains Srimad Bhagavatam 11.21.42. What is the direction of all the Vedic literatures? On whom do they set focus? Who is the purpose of all speculation? Outside of me, no one knows these things. Srila Sukadev Goswami also explains Srimad Bhagavatam 11.29.49. I offer my obeisances to Lord Krishna, the Supreme Person, who, like a bumblebee, collected the honey of the essence of Vedic knowledge, and to destroy their fear of repeated birth and death, made His servants drink it. So we see is that the essence is actually known by Krishna. So here he's pointing out as Brahma studies it, because all the Brahmas study it, and then from that then they get their understanding, but actually the real understanding comes from Krishna. Right? Because before that he was initiated into the study of the Vedas through hearing the sound of Krishna's flute. Right? Then we see is that Brahma studied the whole Vedas, then he asked what's the essence? Right, so you got the four verses. Right, so even though he has studied it three times, but actually it's Krishna who's giving the conclusion. Does that make sense? So he's pointing out is it's something that every Brahma does. He's supposed to do this, because otherwise everyone else would just say, "Oh, he didn't study. I studied them, and he didn't even study them." Right. So who can say they studied all the Vedas, all four Vedas, three times? Right? Somebody does pretty well just to go through, you know, one Veda once. Right? Does that make sense? Right? You know, you're going to study one of the Vedas, it takes a long time. You know, generally like Rig Veda's 12 years. Like that. The Tarvas, I mean, huh? Yes.
I heard the description of the Vedas occupy whole buildings in Calcutta. It's an idea that the size of the continent.
Yeah. No, the Vedas, it's a lot. The problem is we've lost so much. I mean, so here he's talking about Vedas means whatever's there, you know, and the Vedas is eternal. It's always there. Like when Garuda flaps his wings, that air, you know, like you hear the bird sounds when they take off, you know, there's a sound, like these doves take off and you hear this kind of sound when they take off. So when Garuda does that, you hear Samaveda. Like that, you know. So it's, you know, a bit. So when he flaps his wings, then you hear the Samaveda. That's so it's always been there. So here's the point. Then Brahma gets the Vedas stolen from him by the Madhu and Kaitava demons, special mind demons that can go into your mind and steal your memory, right? And so then he asked Krishna, you please teach me the essence. That means I'll have to now restudy the Vedas, but teach me the essence first, because just in case I die before I finish and come to the conclusion, I actually know what the conclusion is. So then for five nights, Krishna described to him the essence of the Veda, and that's known as Pancharatra. Right? So we have the Chaturshloki. You know, is the Bhagavatam. That's the essence of all the Vedas, and then it's given here, so the Bhagavatam is then the conclusion of everything, because it's based on those four. That makes it the natural commentary, right? You have the whole Vedas. The essence of that is given in the Upanishads, right? The philosophical conclusion, right? That's Vedanta. That then is then, I say, standardized in the Vedanta Sutra. Right? So Vedanta Sutra is then is the end of knowledge. Right, the Vedic literature, then the Upanishads, the essence of the Upanishads is the Vedanta Sutra. Now the four Vedas, then the Chaturshloki is their essence. So if you write an expand on those four verses there, it's actually explaining what the Vedanta Sutra is doing. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? You see, you use two parallel lines. Like that. One is going from the Vedas, of the Vedas, then the Upanishads, of the Upanishads, then you get the essence, which is the Vedanta Sutra. Then you get the four Vedas. Krishna then tells what is the essence of that. Bhagavatam expands on that, so it actually explains what Vedanta Sutra is doing. Right? Because Vedanta Sutra is giving it just in short form. Right? But the Bhagavatam can give it in its more elaborate elucidation. So that's why it's not a direct commentary on Vedanta Sutra. It's the natural commentary. Right? You'll see Prabhupada always uses the word natural. He never says it is the commentary or direct. He says it's the natural. Right? Does that make sense? Then we see you have Gita, and then Krishna gives the essence in four verses, the Chaturshloki and the Gita. Right? Because even though he spoke the Gita, which is the essence of the Upanishads, because it's Gita Upanishad, right? Which means it's the essence of the Vedas. But still, within that, we may become confused, so he, in four verses, gives the essence. Right? So we can see from any angle that the essence is always coming from Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? Right? Okay. Any questions on that? Or? Yes.
I have one question concerning what you said about engaging on nature.
Uh-huh.
So if I understand what you said, that in our conditioned state now, it's better if we fully engage our nature in Krishna, and in this way we will be engaged in Him. How our nature is defined? Our nature is what we have capacity to do, or what we are inclined to do? And for example, if we are inclined to do something, but because of mission, it's needed to do something else, then what is recommended to do? Push ourselves to do what is needed for mission, for spreading Krishna consciousness, or just have to do what we are inclined to do? Because if we push ourselves, then we struggle with mind. It's more difficult, more heavy. What is more recommended?
What we're inclined to do and what we're able to do. then you're supposed to find where the two of those meet. Right? In other words, what you can do, what is useful in Shastra, and other things that you can do that you're inclined to do that are supported by Shastra, that's what you take. Right? Then, so that's the first part of your question. The second part is then the difference between just the natural service and emergency service. So natural means what you're inclined to do of what you can do that's supported by Shastra. That's your natural service. Emergency means what needs to be done right now because of the time, place, and circumstance. So basically, emergency always takes precedent over the natural, right? Because an emergency means the time, place, and circumstance aren't favorable for the natural. Right? So therefore, then emergency is done. But you just have to calculate how long you can do emergency service without having any problems. Right? In other words, emergency always will be a problem, but it's workable because you can see the benefit of it. Intellectually, you can see the benefit of it, that it's good for the situation. But you have to judge that how long you can do that also naturally. That's how long it can be done. You know? But if it goes beyond that, then one might have problems, and then one then needs to go back to just doing one's natural service. Does that make sense? But emergent Bhaktivinoda Thakur says emergency always takes precedent over just the natural. Like that. Because it has to be done now, it's an emergency. Right? Does that make sense? You like to sit and study. And your room has caught on fire. So the natural service would be to sit and study. But the emergency service would be deemed more important at this time, because if you want any books to study or a place to study it, then you need to put out the fire. Right? Does that make sense? So even though you're not a fireman, you know, you're a book studier, still the putting out the fire is something you would do. Okay? Does that make sense? So like that. Okay?
You said that energy is still Brahma.
Yeah.
But also that you have to recognize Vishnu can have every heart passion. But does it mean that
is superior energy not present as Paramatma? No, Paramatma is in everything. I mean, see, you have simultaneously, you have the Lord and His energies, and they're not actually separated, but depending upon which element you want to focus on, you'll bring that out. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like here, in this verse here, they're trying to explain Atma to be, they're trying to bring out the element of the source and all-pervasive, because they're trying to point out that we're not the source. We're not all-pervasive. Krishna is. So therefore, they're describing here as At meaning all-pervading, and because He's the supreme mother or source, then is Ma. So Atma means that combination of the original source that is all-pervading. Right? And the point is here is the mother aspect, because maintenance means nourishment. Right? So Krishna means Krishna in His energies, but the actual performance of the activity will be done by His energy. But it's His energy that's doing it under His direction, under His authority. Therefore, it's Him doing it. Right? You have the big man, he's sitting there. And he runs a big company. He has 10,000 workers. He just sits in his office. But, you know, things are being made, things are being shipped, things are being bought, things are being sold. So one could say he's doing all that because it's through his energies. But one could also complain, no, he's just sitting in a chair in his office. What do you mean he's doing all that? You know what I'm saying? So it's simultaneously there and not. So depending upon what you want to bring out, you could say, just like Krishna is making everything work here, but he's not, he is not in it. Right? Because he's sitting in the chair. He's not out there making his hands dirty, it's his energies that are doing that. Because otherwise someone can say, oh, it's Krishna himself personally there in the column, you know, holding up the building. No, it's his energy that's holding it up. You know, because then we start doing column puja, you know. So you have to make a distinction. Or we would say things that we do that aren't, that are, we're doing for ourselves is Krishna, because it's his potencies. We'd spin it like that. But within his said, you know, his energy is there, but he's not there. But when you're talking about how he is all-pervading and he's taking care of everything, then you say it's him. Right? Because you've accepted he is God, he's doing everything, so he's pervaded everything. So for those who will misuse it, then they point out, well, his potency is there, but he's actually separate from it. Does that make sense? So that's why sometimes it may seem to be contradictory, but it's not. Right? It just depends upon which angle you want to look at it by. Does that make sense? Like that. So, like that. Because you always have the point is that you try to establish a point to correct something else. And in doing that, it may correct the previous one, but it may simultaneously create a new doubt. You know? Does that make sense? Yeah. So, therefore, then there's the other viewpoint. Does that make sense? Like that, because it'll switch. Does that make sense? Like that. So, depending on what you want to bring out, then that will be the topic. Does that make sense? Because otherwise, to describe it all at once at the same time and understand it, that God can do. He can understand it, but we can't. You know? Because we're seen. So we have problem. He is the seer, so he sees everything at once and everything is him. So he doesn't have any problem in understanding everything all at once. But we don't. So it has to be explained to us according to our position. Does that make sense? Right? Because we're seen, not seer. So what element that we are seen, you know, in other words, the place where we are, that's going to be our world, right? That's all the bigger it is. So that then we have to connect with. Does that make sense? And because you're talking to different people, their actually sphere is different than someone else. So explaining something to one person will clear that person's doubt, but that same argument may raise the doubt in someone else. Does that make sense? Yes, no? Okay, so then we'll... Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we see here also just the final point is that the essence of the Vedas, the essence of the Vedic knowledge is actually to destroy their fear of repeated birth and death. Right? So fear means not understanding our relationships with the Supreme Lord. Right? Right? And then birth and death means the temporary. So fear is we think we're God, we're the controller. And repeated birth and death means then the temporary aspect. So the point is he's the controller and eternal. So he's existence. So then we can feel safe. Does that make sense? Because otherwise the tendency is we'll feel unsafe. Because once we actually do accept that the material energy is temporary and that, then where do you take shelter? Right? So that's Krishna. So the essence is actually to break this and to get rid of this fear, because you know it's Krishna. Krishna's there. Krishna's taking care. Everything's being done by him. So all this nice fancy activities and knowledge and all that is meant to dismantle our material understanding. But even though that's dismantled, still we're there and Krishna's there, so the relationship is stable. Does that make sense? We don't have to worry there'll be some loss, because otherwise that comes up sometimes. Oh, if we give up everything, what will we have? What will we do? How will we be taken care of? It's not an uncommon thought. No, because you're not giving up everything. It means you're accepting Krishna, right? We're giving up the material conception and accepting Krishna. So you're giving up actually your small sphere of what you think is important in the material world and accepting Krishna, who is everything. So you're not giving up anything, you're actually getting everything. Right? Does that make sense? So that fear to do that we get, means that is removed by understanding the essence of the Vedic literature. Right? That Krishna is the supreme worshipable person, not us. He's the source, so that means anything you require comes from him. Right? So all economics, all security, all emotions, all sense gratification, all knowledge, anything that's important to you, it all comes from him. So to accept him, to worship him, whatever you want, you're getting there, not somewhere else. Is this okay? Yeah, okay. So then we'll end here for today. Jai Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda ki, Chainita Gaur Prema.
May I ask one question?
Is it on the class? How come you don't ask in the class? That's why I keep stopping and says, everybody understand? Is that okay?
It's not connected.
It's not connected. So what does that mean, it's not connected?
It's not in the line of exactly the things which we spoke.
So what is it in line with?
It's just, it came over the last days, just somehow one discussion pop up, and
uh-huh.
We tried to discuss with different devotees, and somehow it's still open.
Okay. So what's the point?
Conclusion.
What's the point? Yeah, but if you say the point itself in one sentence.
So it's about if one story of Bhagavatam from first canto is allegorical, or we can accept it as real as it happened, just because.
Which story?
Maharaj Parikshit is punishing the personification of Kali Yuga.
That happened. That's not an allegory. That's happening. Paranjana, that's an allegory. But it's based on actual, you know, tattva. So it's fact, what he's talking about, all the technicalities. But Paranjana didn't exist. Pachina Barhishat did. Narad Muni talking to him and telling him the analogy, that happened. But he told him that story so that he could get all the different things happening, because he's a king, so he'll naturally understand that whole culture of the king. So then he put it in that and showed all the technical aspects of the philosophy and culture, you know, and what was right and what was wrong through Paranjana. But him going and Kali Raj is there and Parikit Mara is taking his Aukshahiniya and going out there and finding him, and that happened. Purana means history. Like that. So the point is in Paranjana, the history is, the actual fact is Narad Muni spoke to Maharaj Pichina Barhishat and use this analogy to convince him of the Krishna conscious philosophy. Right? Then he went to the forest, and then Krishna Barhishat's sons, the Pachetas, then they became the kings. Right? So that's all explained. Okay.
Think about Manu. Swayambhu Manu, he has a lifespan of 71, I call it Chaturyuga because it's a nice statutory developer. I call it the Chaturyugas.
Mm-hmm.
So 71 Chaturyugas. And he was a king for such a long period.
That's every month.
Yeah, but what happened?
Swayambhuva is the son of Brahma, so he's still alive. But he's not sitting in the seat because he's one of Brahma's sons, so he doesn't go away. He lives as long as Brahma does.
is Chiranjeevi. Because it says in the story of Karuna that life came to an end after 71 Chara Yoga.
Means you could take it as the life of being the Manu. You know what I'm saying? He's not like Indra where it's just there. He comes in, he'll take that post because he's the first one. Someone had to be the Manu. So he's the first one. So he actually starts the mankind because no one else was quite getting it together. The four Kumaras didn't want to have kids. Lord Shiva, his kids, like, it was like, you know, we can do with less of them around. And, you know, like that. Narad Muni wasn't interested. You know, so Brahma had a problem. So the Swayambhu Manu, like that.
But actually, the question is, what did he do in Kali Yuga? Like nowadays, Vaibhishek Manu is ruling, but he's not present. His leadership is not felt by the.
Well, those who follow his laws, yes.
But why is he not physical present like Swayambhu Manu? He has his capital. He came.
He does. He does somewhere, but it's not necessarily here.
But this is the Earth planet.
Yeah, but you know he has a post. It's just like Indra makes the rain happen here also, but he doesn't have to sit here to do it.
Swayambhu Manu has capital in Brahmavarta on this planet. You could meet him in person because he's the king of the human beings.
Yeah, but in Kali Yuga, no one really wants to meet him, do they? See, 71 is Mahayuga, right? So a Kali Yuga is 1/10 of a Mahayuga, right? 9/10 are Satyatreta and Dwapara, right? You got 4 parts, 3 parts, 2 parts, 1 part. That makes 10, right? Yeah. So that means for one of them, to us it's a long time, but to them it's not. So 1/10 of 72 Mahayugas.
That nobody cares for him.
It's a matter of not nobody cares. It means that nobody cares for him. Not that it means those that care are following his laws, right? You have Manu Samhita.
Yeah.
So that's coming from Manu, right? So he's the representative of that Manu, the original Manu.
Is it Manu or the original Manus?
Manu Samhita is Manu actually means Lord Brahma. He's the Manu, right? Because he is the one who then speaks it. It's his. In other words, and then you could say Krishna is the actual Manu, because he's the one that gave them the Dharma Shastra. But Krishna gave it to Brahma. Brahma gave it to his 10 sons. Then the Manu Samhita is the rendition of Brahma's teachings to his sons by Bhrigu. Right? In Bhagavatam you have the rendition of Narad Muni of Manu Samhita. It's the same stuff. You find all the same things, but it's just from the angle of Ekaina Pancharatra and Naishkarmya. While Bhrigu's is there so that those who are Sakam and even who are not devotees can take advantage of it. So that's just Varnashram. But Narad Muni and Bhagavatam, that's Dayavarnashram. So Brahma taught it to his son. So here you have two different renditions of the same knowledge. It's a body of knowledge.
Yeah,
you understand?
Yeah,
Dharmashastra is a body of knowledge. It's a book of knowledge.
Yeah.
Like Upanishad is a body of knowledge. It means, in other words, the knowledge that deals with Brahman, the soul, and understanding the metaphysics of that, that's Upanishad. Mm-hmm. Right? So all the outstanding points that need to be made in Upanishadic literature have been made by other great sages. So those are documented. We may talk the same thing, so it's Upanishad. Right? But we're not those personalities. We're referring to their discussions. Because they, you know, we can't take it to the depth and the breadth that they did. So, but it's technically we're discussing the book of, you know, like here we're discussing Bhagavatam. But like the best form of the Bhagavatam is what was spoken by Sukadeva to Parikshit, as then described by Sutta to the sages of Naimisharanya. That makes sense?
Yeah. I just was thinking of one reference when you said about this books of knowledge. It seems Brahma had two kinds of lines. One is a seminal line, and one is a Vaishnava Sampradaya in which we are coming. Of course, both are the same. Because
well, the seminal line, that's called Gotra.
Gotra. And that is what... in that line,
but with him it's not seminal because they're all mind culture. That's what it means. That's what Gotra is. This means Gotra, there's 21 Prajapatis who are either sons or grandsons of Brahma. So which one your line goes back to, that's your Gotra.
But that means that the Manu Samhita was given in the Gotra line. It's for those who do not follow the Vaishnava Sampradayic line of Brahma, then they have to follow.
No, Manu Samhita is for everybody. The Vaishnavas also follow Manu Samhita.
But the spiritual aspect of it.
Of course. Because the point is, Dharma Shastra gives something for everyone. It tells how the whole society stays together. Everyone in society is not necessarily Vaishnava. So if they're not, then all the details are there how to make it work. If they are, you don't have to use it. Just like devotees, you wouldn't need to use the capital punishment or corporal punishment.
Yeah. You're brown,
so so you would classify it like that. They'd fall into that category. So that cuts out, a huge amount of the discussions on punishments and atonement. Your whole 11th chapter is not really required. There's maybe 5-10 verses in there that are important, meaning that if in the assembly of the Vaishnavas, then there you explain your problem and all that, then, and they give you advice on that, it's cleared. It's that you don't have to go stand in your head and do all kinds of funny things in your atonement. It's just that you've explained it to them and they've, accepted your attitude and given you direction how to rectify it, then it's done, finished. Right? So that's what we use. But those who are more mundane, then they get into the moralistic aspect, so they want to see, physical austerity and suffering. Yeah, so that's all. That's for mundaners. Like that. It's not for Vaishnavas. For Vaishnavas, it's the attitude. And the attitude is done by the association discussions of senior devotees, not by junior people who happen to have a laptop and an email address, and they have fingers and they know how to type and push buttons that say send. That has nothing to do with Manu Samhita. Persons like that, their tongue would be cut out according to Manu Samhita. Yeah, so that's the thing. Or it depends if they always use this one to push send, then they would cut that one off. They'd have to push it.
Well, I have this difficulty. If he is ruling for 71 Chatur Yugas, why is he not? It seems that inevitably.
What's your problem? No, here the problem is what? You can't go and see him. Is that the problem?
Maybe that's the problem. Yeah.
That's the problem.
To see him.
Yeah. So then, make yourself qualified. Then maybe you will.
Because he's the real king of the humans.
He is, but the point is what's more important, seeing the king or following the king's rules? So is Vapu more important or Vani?
Yeah, Vani's more important.
So then Vani is there. You have it right there. Manu Samhita is right there.
But isn't it strange that the king loses his power?
He doesn't lose his power. It's just no one wants to deal with him, so that's left. A person who doesn't accept your authority, you just banish. You don't punish them, because then there'll be no correct... It means the king punishes the person for their benefit. But if they don't accept the punishment, then they're just banished.
Well, why are they banished? Because the earth belongs to him.
No, you're banished from your kingdom, you can go to someone else's kingdom. My point is not the banishment. My point is that if no one's interested in listening to you, then you don't exert your authority. He just, he's got plenty to do. There's plenty of people. It's only 1/10 of the time, right? You know what I'm saying? If in your 24 hours, then 2 hours and some minutes, you had everything. The rest of the time, everything worked fine. and 2 hours and 20 minutes, nobody cared about the thing, why would you bother? You wouldn't even bother going to court, right? Would you? No, you just stay in your room and have a good time. Sit with your friends or do something else.
That's extreme.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, why deal? If no one wants to listen to you, no one cares, why bother? You know, there's dignity. You don't waste your time. So why you waste your time?
I have another question which Jani Mashpurgh asked to Maharaj yesterday. It was a kind of funny question the way he put it. He said, who's the supreme enjoyer? Jani Mashpurgh asked this question. And it created doubt in me because I'm still thinking about this.
No, Krishna is the supreme enjoyer.
He asked who is the supreme enjoyer in this
universe. Oh, yeah, in this universe, yeah, he said, in this universe. Then Maharaj said, yeah, it's Krishna. Then he said, but Krishna never touched matter, so who's the enjoyer?
It's the universal form. It's still Krishna. Because the point is no one can enjoy anything except if Krishna is not enjoying it. So he wants to taste, therefore all taste is there. But you see, there's the difference. See, this is why is Purana separated into Sarga and Visarga? Right? Sarga is the blueprint on which it actually functions. And Visarga is where the living entity themselves takes ownership of that activity, even though it's not them. So in Krishna, he's having his pastime. It's between him and his potency. So material energy he doesn't enjoy, he's sporting with Lakshmi. But Lakshmi, you have to remember, is expanded as the material energy. Right? And Krishna is expanded as Shambhu.
Then he's a supreme enjoyer in the universe as Shambhu.
Yeah.
Okay, that's right. Because I guess that must be the answer. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, but that's not important because what our concept of what enjoyment is and what is actually enjoyment is going on are different. So we wouldn't understand what supreme enjoyer meant anyway. Because unless you're an enjoyer, how do you actually understand what supreme enjoyment is? But so unless you're enjoying according to Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, you don't actually know what enjoyment is. You know what I'm saying? You have a mother, and the kid wants, you know, something, wants some attention, wants something to eat, and she's busy talking on the phone, and she's enjoying the conversation of gossip with her friends. Can you actually say she's enjoying?
No.
No, because the actual thing would be taking care of the kid and that interaction. That's the real thing. So the other one is basically, it's not actually primary rasa. It means she's ignoring primary rasa for secondary rasa. Because you could say, oh, well, the what's actually primary rasa is her and her friend. But actually, what is being tasted? The friendship between her and her friend? That, or the astonishment, oh, did you hear this one did that? Oh, no, really? Oh, my God. You know, so it's astonishment. Right?
It's happening all the time.
Yeah, so that's the whole point in the third verse, the invocation. Is that Prabhupada, one of the things that's being, you know, that at least I understood was being made there, is in this material world, unless you're following Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, no one is tasting primary rasa. They're all tasting the seven secondary. Otherwise, the friends are out together, but what are they doing? They're doing something else, just laughing, joking, or something. Then actually, the bond between them is not actually what's being tasted.
It's a problem the government doesn't support that. Like, you know, in the West, they want to train women as boys in order to get them to work, and then they get more tax. So then you get this weird kind of person.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's it. So but at the same time as the men know what they're doing, then it still works in China. It's like that. They've got it down where they even wear the same clothes, you know, like that. And they can do all the same duties and everything, but they still can maintain male and female. I don't know, now is it becoming westernized, but in the natural Chinese culture, they're able to maintain. Because maleness and femaleness is an attitude, not necessarily an activity. Right? You have a mother, she has her kids, her husband's died, like that, and so she has to go out and work and do some, you know, wash people's clothes over at the Grihastha area over there. Mm-hmm. To maintain her family, but it doesn't mean that she loses her, you know, that whole feminine and mother. It's just an attitude. The point is the government doesn't want the women to be all nasty and all that. They want to get money from them. It means if we're taking your point that you're making,
yeah, but they're getting nasty because of that.
that's there because they're not being trained how to maintain the proper attitude.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? My point is it's not the ideal thing. Our ideal thing is they have a nice family situation. They don't have to do that. Right? But if they don't, then it's also natural that women do some work.
But they are trying to become competitors of men. That's the...
I mean, it's
equal.
No, because of your particular angle on Varnashram, that form of it is what's important, right? So therefore will look like that. They're not training them to be like that. They're training them to be economically viable. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
They're not trying, hey, what can we do to really, you know, make these women into nasty people? No. They're trying, how can we do to make them produce money? So it's, in other words, it's a Vaishya mentality. And Vaishya mentality doesn't really care for religious principles. They care for economics. And so therefore morality is important as long as it, if it, as in the support of economics.
Yeah.
If it doesn't get in the way of their economics, they don't care for morality either.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But religion they don't care for at all. Right? So they don't actually know the inherent nature. They only study religion enough to find out what's the nature of what I can, how profit I can get from it. So that's called niti. Right? Niti is how, what is the psychology of something to get the proper result. That's niti.
I thought niti has something with politics on it.
That's not politics. Getting what you want out of somebody is not politics.
Yeah, it's politics.
Yeah, so politics is artha. Artha shastra is politics. So economics, justice, morality, you know, this ism, that ism, it's all the same thing. It's not different. It's just different aspects of the two, of the same thing, different angles of it. This is a book. Oh, but the book also has some weight to it, you know.
Yeah. No, I didn't put economics and politics. I always separated these two.
No. Why is it called Artha Shastra? Right? Pretty direct. You understand?
Yes.
What do they use in Japan as their, traditionally, as their economic shastra?
In Japan? I don't know.
The Book of Five Rings by Musashi, which is a book on martial arts.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you need protection, whereas I have economics.
No, but you also, it's just the same way, is that you have politics of the kingdom, you have politics of the company, you have politics of the individual relationship. It's the same thing. Diplomacy is politics, and you use diplomacy everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Diplomacy is all thing. You know,
Shukraniti.
Huh? Yeah. But all of them, it's all the same thing. Niti just means is that you deal in such a way as to get the proper result. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's the thing, is that you see art means politics and economics on the same platform, and it works. Then and morality, justice, it's the same thing. It's just different forms of the same thing. Then pranamoy is not a problem to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's run by the Kshatriyas, though.
No, it means they use it because they're getting overall, because the artha of the Kshatriya is protection. The artha of the Vaishya is economics.
Mm-hmm.
But the Kshatriya, by protecting the Vaishyas, gets economics.
Yeah.
No, the Kshatriyas see to Dharma. Right? Like that. And so they use diplomacy for there. It means everybody uses diplomacy. Even you preach, you still use diplomacy. What do you say, what words you use is still diplomacy. Diplomacy just means taking into consideration the other person's mentality and speaking in such a way that you get the result you want. So result we want is them to become, understand the philosophy and take it up. So that's the gain we're trying to get by using our diplomacy. Right, but it's being used on the Bhagavad platform. Does that make sense? Like that. Or someone does that to gain, you know, Brahman you know, understanding, or someone does it just to the, you know, the proper religious, you know, environment, or someone does it for economics, or someone does it for sense gratification. It's the same thing. It's just a matter of, it's the same entity, but just when you apply it in sense gratification, you use it like this. You apply it in politics, you use it like this, or in economics, you use it like this, or in, you understand? It's the same. Right? You have a knife and you want to cut bread, you use it differently than you're cutting a potato. Right? You saw bread, you cut a potato, you slice a potato, but it's the same knife. You know what I'm saying? So that's the thing, is we think it's all different because of the mode of passion. We think it's all different things, but it's the same thing. Just like mode of passion, you think it's different souls. So oh, there's devotees and there's non-devotees, or Christians and Muslims, but they're the same soul. It's no difference. So mode of passion makes us like that. So the mode of passion will also do that with us, with the knowledge. To say, you know, this body is different from this, is different from this. It actually is the same thing. Does that make sense? It's just which angle you look at it from, which way you're perceiving it, then you call it by that knowledge, branch of knowledge. You know? Does that make sense? How to identify the disease? What are you identifying the disease with? You're identifying the disease based on what is the astrological influence has created the particular body and diseases that are there. So you're simply using the medical science to identify what disease is there. But you could also use astrology to identify it. You could also use psychology. You can use, you know, so many things you could do. But it's the same science. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Where the planet is, that's astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
What influence that planet has on your birth chart, that's called astrology. What influence that planet in that position has on what's going on around you, that's called omens. You know, what it did to your physical form, then that's called palmistry or physiognomy. Right? On the question you're going to ask, that's called prashna. It's the same science. That makes sense? So depending upon what you're doing with it, then you call it by these different things. And that's within the same science, but actually technically between the sciences, it's all the same thing. Because they all function on the same thing. They all function on some mandabhidaya prayoja. You know?
Right, since you give this example of Muslim and Christian, you see like that. But sometimes I think it's more difficult to be a Samadarshi if you're among Muslims, because they simply will not take up, you know, or path.
But they don't have to. One doesn't have to take up the path to be Sama. Sama means, as you see, it's the soul, and they're doing whatever that they want to do.
Happening.
Oh, it's happening. Okay. Very good. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of, it doesn't make sense. You know, this pillar is also not taking it. This rock has not been known for doing, you know, great kirtans. And, I mean, we don't know about it, at least, you know, like that. You know.
But they don't come in examples of great data centers like that.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So therefore, it's just the same soul, but it's just become, its particular material attachment has created this mentality that makes them the way they are. So they react that way. You know, like a dog. It's a same soul, but it's just developed that particular angle or attitude. So therefore, it now acts as a dog and thinks as a dog. So what you see is, the easiest thing with them is to see the human element. They have their particular way they go about trying to establish or maintain their faith. You know, it's just like faith can't be very strong if you're not tolerant to others. Mm. Right? If you have to go and destroy everybody else and either kill them or this or that, means your faith isn't very strong. It means if you need that to maintain your own. If it's used as a technique to actually spread the philosophy, that's another thing. You know, but the point is for yourself, if you require that, then that means your faith isn't very great. Because otherwise, this is what I do. It's just like if the two of us go to a restaurant, you know, and we get the menus, and then you order, you know, very happily, and then I order something different, and it's kind of like, well, why did you order that? You know, is the stuff I ordered not good? You know, is your stuff better or something like that? You know what I'm saying? So then it's a matter of, you know, this is what you like, this is what I like, so it's fine. But it's a matter of we all have to eat the same thing, otherwise, you know, only certain items on the menu are cool, everything else is stupid. So did I order the stupid ones and he ordered the cool, or did I order the cool ones and he ordered the stupid ones? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So motive passion creates that. But the point is all those things are on there, so for whatever your taste is, you take that, and you know, what's the problem?
Is samadarshi something from the internal, or is it has to be also external? Means dealing in the same way Rikushi comes.
Means the point is external is based on internal, but if you don't have any internal, then at least externally you deal nicely with everybody. Mm-hmm. But the samadarshi means internally that you would see everybody in the proper attitude. Therefore, your dealings would be good, be proper. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Was there a question you wanted to ask me, Jonathan? Was there a question about your family yesterday?
Yeah.
So, I'm going to make a point on the first part of the course.
Right.
You can open it to the